listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 15th installment of a conversation that we've been having with Professor Luciana Bone about the political economy of the Soviet Union. And where we left off last week was somewhere between Red Vienna and Austrofascism, and so we'll pick up in Red Vienna. Welcome back.
Thank you, Don. So yeah, the topic today is Red Vienna, and the nickname Red Vienna was given to the Social Democratic administration of the capital of Austria between 1919 and 1934. So the question that should preoccupy us is, you know, how strong is social democracy, or how strong was social democracy in the context of European and worldwide capitalist crisis in the particularly 1929. And Europe in the grip of fascism. How strong can social democracy be without a police and army and without seizing the means of production? Does that
right.
make sense?
Yes.
Okay. So for the Communist Third International, that's the one that comes before the 1935 one, which calls for a united front. But anyway, for the Communist Third International, which was acting during the 1928-29 crisis, for the Third International and Moscow, its social democracy is not very strong under the brunt of fascism. So we know that in the end, in 1934, the guns of the dictator Engelbert Dollfuss in Austria destroyed Red Vienna. And so, you know, for the communist democracies in popular democracy, in the Soviet state, they already had an opinion that the Vienna, Red Vienna was more pink than red.
Right.
And so there was a debate about that. But anyway, you know, already Machiavelli had said that prophets who are armed can resist and possibly prevailed. Prophets who are disarmed go toward your ruin.
Right.
So, you know, it's a well-known idea that power comes from the barrel of a gun.
That's absolutely right. Yep.
Yeah, as Mao said. But nevertheless, it has to be said that the socialist administration of Vienna, and it was left, very left, in Otto Bauer, for example, and also liberal in a branch. But anyway, Vienna became the interwars, became the most extensive European experiment in municipal social democracy between the two wars. It was impressive. It was not a revolution, as the end showed, but I think it was a sort of utopian experiment that attracts people today who talk about politics are local, you know.
Right.
So the Social Democrats administration in Vienna had virtual sovereignty thanks to a 1921 constitutional provision that made Vienna an independent province. It's just a fluke of the Republican switch from the monarchy to democracy in 1918.
Right.
Or, you know. So how did they do it? How did Vienna become Red Vienna? What did they do? Well, they introduced new taxes. And these taxes were imposed on luxury, on riding horses, on large private cars, on armies of servants in private households and in hotel rooms. So at a certain point, the municipality published a list of social institutions that could be financed by the servants' tax the Vienna branch of the Rothschild family had to pay. And they claimed that about 50% of their social services was financed by a luxury tax. Now, this was disbelieved. It was thought to be propagandist exaggeration, but recent historians have done research on the records in the municipal archives, and it was considerable, the luxury tax. The luxury tax contributed at least 36% to these benefits that accrued to the population.
So what we're talking about here is this, that, I mean, because the argument over whether or not it played a significant role boils down to, were these people making so much money that a tax on it could pay for half of the needs of the population? And the answer, more or less, they're starting to prove to those who didn't believe it, it was yes. That's how much money these rich people make.
That's right. Yes. And look at what happened. Look at what they did. They constructed 400 apartment complexes. Complexes, not 400 apartments.
Right.
64,000 new apartments in all.
Hmm.
Now, these housed one-tenth of the city's population. And the pride of Vienna and the symbol of the residential building program was the majestic Karl Marx Hof, the Karl Marx House.
Hmm.
And it was designed by a famous, a good modernist architect, Karl Lenn.
Hmm.
I wish I could remember to tell the audience to read an architectural book on by an architectural expert of Red Vienna architecture, but they can easily look it up, and it contains the history as well.
Yeah.
And okay, so no, I was going to interject something else. Anyway, this Karl Marx half stretched and stretches because it's been refurbished lately. I don't know when, the last 20 years maybe. It stretched almost a mile along a railway line, which is significant. They still had to build in the working class suburbs,
right,
sections. These had to be, you know, it was symbolic that it was people's power, but it was still at the edges of the city.
Right.
So it's still the longest, the major apartment complex in the world, Karl Marxhof. If you ask anybody who goes to Vienna, they never heard of it, but they do conduct tours. You can look it up, and you can actually have a tour of Red Vienna architecture, but it's just not known, you know. Anyway, the Karl Marxhof featured five great monumental archways, and they were constructed with a facade of red and yellow stucco, very appealing. It had interior courtyards, state-of-the-art kindergartens, playgrounds, maternity clinics, healthcare offices, lending libraries, laundries,
communities,
and other social services.
They were they were planned communities, and you had a green. The courtyards were, you know, had greens and everything. And here's the kicker: 4% of the household income was the rent. 4%.
Yeah, it's rather like Cuba.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's about a
4%?
Tenth. Yeah, 4% of the household income, and in the private buildings it had been 30%. Now, they also passed and read Vienna. Just to digress for a second, a Tenant Protection Act, and the Tenant Protection Act froze rents because they had inflation of rents. You know, like a big run up after the war, and it continued over the, you know, into the teens and twenties. They froze the rents at the level of 1914. So. First of all, new housing projects became unprofitable because they couldn't gouge anymore because of the rent control. Mm-hmm. And so they used a rental tax and a luxury tax to build Karl Marxhof. And then because they did that and the costs were cheap, you had 4% income. And that drove down the price in the marketplace for the other part, for the private stuff. And you had the Tenant Protection Act to cap them anyway. So the housing went from taking a third to half or more of someone's income, like it does today, to 4%.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So in addition to these communal houses, and we must add too, that there was a tremendous shortage of people housing too, right?
Yep.
After the war. Right. I mean, we're talking about an empire.
That's right.
Isn't it peculiar that empires, the people at home, I mean, are so almost like their colonies? In other words, the metropolitan empire has masses of as poor people as those of the colonies that the empire exploits.
Internal colonies. That's, you know, Malcolm X spoke about that here with black folks. Yep,
Which is what is happening in the United States with the poverty rate, the unemployment, etc.
Yep.
Yeah. So in addition to communal houses, the Social Democrats instituted vacation grounds, recreational holidays, very much like the Soviet system, public baths and spas, sports facility, kindergartens and parks for children to play in. And all this had to do with hygiene and health, open air, exercise. It was basic. So the administration said, what we spend for youth homes, we will save on prisons. What we spend for the care of pregnant women and babies, we will save in hospital for mental illnesses. And, I mean, we have to note the similarity between what the Soviet government did when it could, starting in the 30s. And these people, they're doing the same things, but their defense against overthrow is not the same.
Right.
So as a result, you know, medical services were free, tuberculosis dropped 50%, parents, and this, I think, is the most significant, which is why I included a most telling action. Parents got clothes packages for
each babies,
new baby.
Right. So they didn't have to be wrapped in a newspaper, which
in
apparently was the practice.
Can you imagine?
Wow. That's a far cry from swaddling clothes, huh?
Uh-huh.
In a Catholic country.
And this is the empire, the capital of an empire
right.
that ruled all the way through Ukraine.
Yep.
And down south to Albania.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so, of course, infant mortality dropped to below the general Austrian average. Gas was affordable, electricity was affordable, garbage collection was affordable. And all this improved health standards. And the services were run by the state, by the municipal authorities. So, of course, as a result of this investment, the rate of unemployment in Vienna dropped in relation to the Austria, to the rest of Austria and Germany. As we mentioned, investments were financed by taxes, not by credits. So that the city administration stayed independent of creditors and did not have to pay interest on bonds. Interestingly, I was reading about China, Mao's China, and in spite of, you know, some of the misguided, supposedly, policies, by the end of the 60s, something like that, China had no debt.
No foreign debt.
That's one of the achievements of Mao.
Yep.
And it was the Soviet Union under Khrushchev, or maybe just, under Khrushchev, that demanded that China pay back in all sorts of things like pigs, the debt that Stalin had granted them.
Right.
And that was, you know, that's still a source of, I mean, they worked their butts off to pay back the Soviet Union, which wanted to be paid back to control China. To be able to control policy. And then those were the bad years, 1960s, between, you know, that's Khrushchev is phase one of what we call the fall of capitalism, which was really an overthrow.
Yeah, of communism.
The fall of communism,
That's right. And, you know, just to continue on digressing in that direction for a moment, the debt was also used to take that, you know, as further to take down the Warsaw Pact and ultimately the USSR, because what happened was that the you know, the financial institutions of the West began lending money to Poland and some of the other Eastern European countries.
Mm-hmm.
They used that money to, rather than to further develop their economies, they used it for political purposes to buy consumer goods. They essentially got people there, you know, hooked on Levi's and, you know, other products of the West, ended up with debt. And then suddenly, when they started pushing, they cut off the cash flow and they started activating their people on the ground, like Walesa and others. And those people had material complaints. Suddenly, I can't get any more Levi's, or I can't get this or that. In addition to that, they used it to finance a separate, like a two-tier economy, which we've discussed a little bit, like talking about Cuba, for example, where they had the Berioska stores, where if you had Western currency, you could buy goods that would only be sold. They would not honor rubles. You couldn't buy anything with rubles from a Western economy because the Western economy wouldn't take it. So you had to get your hands on dollars. They would either be loaned from the West or people would come with dollars into it. And so they would buy, stock these stores that most people couldn't go to because they didn't have dollars. And it created all kinds of social unrest inside the country. And these were the seeds. Basically, debt and finance were, you know, some of the strongest influences that were used to take down the Soviet bloc.
I see. And then the next step was to destroy the Communist Party.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw it in Trieste, which is on the border of Yugoslavia. Mm. People from Yugoslavia streaming in, buying Levi's to sell back in Yugoslavia, wearing right. three or four of them with on top dresses to get. In the 80s, this happened.
Right. Yep.
It was obvious.
Yep.
So they were being addicted to luxury, to these stupid, cheap yeah. luxury items.
Yeah. Same thing. When I was in Moscow in 1990, and I smoked Lark cigarettes. They're American cigarettes. So I could use a pack of American cigarettes to go in to get into one of the fanciest restaurants in Moscow, the Praga down the Arbat, and you know, I could jump the head of the line just holding it up to the door at the entrance, and for a carton I could take 10 people out to dinner there. Well, I bought Russian cigarettes, Zavtra. There were few brands. While I was there, I was smoking those because I liked them better. It's just they were in cheesy packaging. They weren't all glitzed out and cellophane and all this other crap. But the tobacco was real tobacco,
right?
And they were better. And yet, you know, people get marketed these things, and they're used as political weapons.
Amazing. It just, yes. And I think that we're digressing, but we're almost there because, you know, the next step to overthrow Vienna is the accession of power of Adolfo, so it's okay.
Right. Yeah.
But... yeah, in Cuba, I mean, I was told, it was already 1997, that Fidel Castro and his administration, his crew, became very worried about this opening of the second economy and dual monetary, you know, and having French bakeries selling goods that could be bought by... foreign currency, whatever,
right.
you know, and other things that it would cause this seduction.
Right.
And so his answer was to simply blitz the country with programs on television on art and promoting arts, opening markets. I don't know if you saw the markets where I knew a couple in the university, and she, to earn money, she painted things and sold them at the market, you know? And suddenly there was this exuberance of artistic production, and the idea behind it was that if you could express yourself in art, not only, you know, could you earn the bread from tourists, but also you were, you made your own stuff.
Right.
Do you understand?
That's right.
In other words, art, not do you understand. Am I making myself clear?
No, I understand what you're saying. Yeah, no, I understand. Yeah. You are making yourself clear.
What
yes.
can we give them but the satisfaction of production in an artistic, way that would combat the seduction of these silly things?
Right. You have on the one hand, actual... art, you know, people's art, folk art, they can call it some of it, but some of it's a much higher level of development than bourgeois art even. And and on the other hand, you have, you know, Campbell soup cans, you know, with Andy Warhol and old Pomo stuff and all of that, which is used to market, you know, commodities, basically. And I went, I did see this in Cuba, and I actually went to the home of José Rodríguez Fuster, who is one of Cuba's most famous artists. He has the whole neighborhood he has done in ceramics, and it's just massive. It's like a living art, the whole neighborhood. It feels
public art.
Yes, and public and private. Along the sidewalks, you know, there are ceramic murals and all kinds of pools of, you know, water, all kinds of things. You go into some houses like his house, he's the main artist there. He has almost like a ceramic Sistine Chapel ceiling sort of thing, only instead of, you know, the two fingers that are touching, instead of one being high and one being low, they're side by side. You know, this kind of, like, socialist, communist, you know, culture and public art, that kind of thing. So all right, let's go back, because we're down to about 7-8 minutes. So go ahead.
Okay. So we're at the point where things change and Red Vienna is eliminated. So in 1933, and by 1934, Red Vienna was crushed because what followed was Austro-fascism. And the man who installed it was this guy, Engelbert Dollfuss, who, if you look at the pictures, was very, very short. So they called him Milli Metternich. You know, Metternich.
Yes.
19th century. And so Milli, meaning Milli,
Mini-me.
And so anyway, he was an ardent Catholic and a member of the Social Christian Party, which we talked about being very conservative. Yeah. Well, a throwback to before the 1789 revolution. I mean, the whole 19th century, as far as the Catholic Church was concerned, I'm not so sure about the Protestant, but as far as the Catholic, the Vatican, it was a counter-reformation again, you know, like a second counter-reformation.
Right.
The Vatican recalled the election of bishops in local places, for example.
Right.
You know, the what you call it, investment had to come from Rome. I mean, they fought like fiends in the 19th century, the Vatican, not to lose their power.
Right.
Anyway, he had an unremarkable career. He's a typical bureaucrat of a party, except for his staunch support for the conservative party. And of course, he had clerical connections at the high level.
Right.
This Vienna bishop has always been a maker of popes anyway.
Right. This was the home of the empire. This was the home of what came out of the Holy Roman Empire. So, this was the European and, the Southwest Asian Empire.
Whatever the Bishop of Vienna was during the John Paul, second pope, the Polish pope, Wojtyla.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, that Fischer, I think, was his name, Bishop of Vienna, had everything to do with Wojtyla's election.
Absolutely.
I mean, Wojtyla wasn't even a preferential, a major choice.
Yeah, they practically appointed him. And so now we're talking about transitioning from Red Vienna to Austro-fascism, which is Roman Catholic, and then a few short years later, that's supplanted by Pan-Germanic fascism, or the Nazi Party, basically, the Germans, Hitler, and Protestant.
Yeah, that's what we're talking about. By 1932, Engelbert gets into the parliament, and we have, it's so minute, but we have the same pattern we had in Italy and in all other fascism. It's a coup. The liberals play dead. Somebody, and these strong men step into the role. Now, do we have time to go into this?
Yeah, we have 3 minutes.
You summarized it well. So Red Vienna, by 1932, Dollfuss, this little man, is in power. By 1933 is the crucial year. Constitution suspended, legislation suspended. About 200,000 Jews lose the vote. About 177,000 of mixed race lose the vote. And this is 33, it's the watershed year where Austrofascism actually happens and takes power. And by 1934, in February, there is a three-day uprising, and the symbolic action is that Dollfuss calls in, not the symbolic, the actual action is the calls in the army to bomb Karhoff House, which is, that is symbolic.
Yeah.
And causing the army in the Vienna municipality. We have to remember that Austria had been a federation of, I think, four sections, I'm not sure. But this federation had been dissolved by Dollfuss and centralized into his hands. So Vienna lost its sovereignty, and Dollfuss called in the army, and Hofhaus and others, of course, and was bombarded and damaged. And then what follows is what follows in every fascism. You get suspensions of civil rights.
They dissolved the Communist Party of Austria in May of 1933, the Socialist Workers' Party in June. Then they get down to what was called the Free Thinkers Guild in June after they get rid of the communists. Then they go after where the Social Democrats were in Linz in February of 1934. And by May Day, ironically enough, they proclaim the May Constitution, and they take down Republic out of the name, and it's now a federal state, and they're building essentially an authoritarian structure.
Yes. And the difference between them, Austro-fascists, and the Austro-Nazis is the two things. One, they didn't agree on the unification with Germany, which had been forbidden by the Versailles Treaty anyway. And the second thing is that Dollfuss's party identified itself as Catholic.
You know, the divergence is, you know, essentially a product of the divergent histories of each of these places and the
exactly.
You know, social expectations.
And, yeah. And one of the things we also need to talk about is the role of the church as it becomes so prominent in the Austro-fascism, and also how fascism makes these alliances with the church, as in Italy. I mean, Mussolini was an atheist. He didn't care about religion. And yet he had to make, and he made a peace with the Vatican, which was devastating because it required compensation. The Vatican demanded compensation for losing the lands of Italy that he had formerly controlled.
Right.
He agreed that.
Yep. Okay, and we'll pick up there next week. Lucia,
yeah,
thank
we'll
you
talk
very
about
much.
The church, and then we'll go on to the other fascism.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure. Bye-bye.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. We've grown accustomed to the strange twists and turns of the so-called scandal known as Russiagate, as well as the intensely partisan nature of investigations and media coverage. We also know this is all about the very existence of the Trump presidency. But who will investigate the investigators? Crosstalking whether the Trump presidency will survive, I'm joined by my guest, Philip Giraldi in Washington. He is a former CIA counterterrorism specialist who is now executive director of the Council for the National Interest. Also in Washington, we have William Beeney. He is a former technical director at NSA. And in Philadelphia, we cross to Dave Lindorf. He is an independent U.S. investigative journalist who has published regularly on different news sites, including Counterpunch. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules. In fact, that means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Phil, let me go to you first in Washington. As you know, I've been following this story from its inception, every twist and turn, as I said in the introduction. I'm absolutely sick of this story, to be honest with you. Watching the executive officers of social media speaking in front of Congress, I thought, you know, one side looked buffoonish and the other side looked like idiots. Okay, really, it crushes any sense of intellectual honesty when you watch that kind of broadcast here. You know, Phil, so I'm really kind of interested in your opinion of the broader picture. This is a strategy to unseat a democratically elected president. Will they succeed, Phil?
Well, I don't know. The honest answer is I don't know. The To unseat the president, it would require them discovering some illegality carried out by him personally. And I don't see that yet. And I don't think this commission, after 1 year, more than 1 year of activity, has come up with anything either. So I don't think that's really what will come out of this. But there are other things that will come out of it. For example, the focus on Russia is unfortunate and has ruined the relationship between Moscow and Washington.
Yep.
And it will get worse from here, I think. Bear in mind that Mueller is not out to investigate the president per se. He's out to investigate Russian meddling in the last election, and there's bipartisan support for this. It's coming from Republicans like McCain and Graham, and it's also coming from the Democrats. So there's a lot of interest in going after Russia on this for various reasons. And the secondary issue, to a certain extent, is how will they hang something on Donald Trump? I don't think they'll be able to impeach him, but I think they will be able to make a lot of trouble for him.
You know, Bill, weigh in on that, because they want to investigate something. Let's face it, gentlemen, if there was something out there, it would have been leaked by now, okay? I mean, that makes common sense. And considering all of the leaking that has happened during this presidency, and now they go out after this, you know, these low-level guys, this George Papadopoulos and something like that, you know, but they don't want to investigate anything else that has facts attached to it. Fusion GPS, okay? Also, people have mentioned Uranium One, the Clinton Foundation, the connections to Ukraine. I mean, it's as if the special prosecutor has to maneuver through a minefield to avoid touching on real evidence. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I've argued from the beginning, from August of 2016, that this was a false argument from the beginning, simply because NSA has all the data on that's going across the network. They own the network. They've got so many taps here in the United States, so many trace route programs, so they can follow all the packets wherever they're going, not just here in the United States, but also around the world. And if they had any evidence, they like a few years ago, the Chinese had hacked into the United States, and the NSA came out indirectly. They weren't named, but they said it came from this building in Shanghai. Well, I mean, they could do that with any hack, because buried in all these packets is all that evidence, and they've got it, and they're not telling anybody about it because they don't have it. That's the point. That's the point I made back in 2016, that they were simply barking at the breeze, creating smoke somewhere that there was none.
Yeah. You know, Dave, it's one of the interesting things after Mueller had his indictments of Manafort and Gates. The theory, obviously, started immediately, is that this is pressure to flip Manafort. What if there's nothing to flip for? What if there is nothing there? And this is what I find really interesting, is that I think if they had had something, they would have already mentioned it, okay, instead of just going through his financial transactions. Go ahead, Dave, in Philadelphia.
Well, they did apparently flip Papadopoulos. So, I mean, I think...
Oh, yeah, but...
I think that Mueller is not... Well, let me finish.
Sure.
I think that Mueller is actually trying to get some indictments of higher-ups, and I think he is playing that typical prosecutor game of getting the smaller fish and trying to flip them so that they can get the bigger fish. That's a given. I think he does want to get prosecutions. Where he wants to go with it is another question. But with regard to Trump, I think that, Phil is right that there has not been much success at this point in finding anything on Trump. But there is, you have to remember that there has been some movement from the IRS in terms of Mueller getting in touch with them. And I think that it is possible, and if Trump is going to get attacked and be brought down, it's going to be on financial stuff. It's not going to be on the Russian connection, because actually,
exactly.
It does seem like there's not much there.
And Phil, that's exactly right, okay? I mean, so with Manafort, it's basically Ukraine, okay? Oh, with the Podesta brothers, maybe he might one day want to look into that also, okay? But Dave is absolutely right. Is it all of these investigations, all of this hysteria, and it will be, what, in 1996, one form of this tax return of that, and it'll be some kind of, oh, my God, it'll be a game changer. Because, again, this Russiagate thing, as you pointed out in the top of the program, it just really, really damaged, I mean, possibly for a generation, U.S.-Russia relations. And I can tell you, gentlemen, on our audience here, a lot of the Russian political leaders are saying, okay, then we'll go elsewhere. You don't want to have a relationship. The world goes on. Go ahead, Phil.
Yeah, well, I absolutely agree with all of that. The what we're going to see, I suspect, and I have no inside knowledge on this, is that a lot of these people were engaged in things like tax evasion,
right,
which wealthy people in the United States and elsewhere tend to do because they like to hide their assets, they like to hide their income. So Manafort it probably will turn out, is certainly guilty of tax evasion, money laundering, you name it. The question is, well, is Donald Trump guilty of these things? And I suspect, of course, that Mueller will be looking at that. So we could have an issue with Donald Trump and with money. The man was a speculator, was a builder, was a developer. I wouldn't be awfully surprised if this sort of thing came out of it. But again, the unfortunate thing is the focus of all this is on Russia,
right,
and on the election. And I think that is the serious damage that's being done here, because it goes on and on and on without any evidence being demonstrated, as Bill mentioned, nothing being demonstrated to tie Russia to any of this. And all it's doing is making the world a less safe place and damaging relationships that could have been good.
Yeah, but you know, but Bill, you know, but as you pointed out, and you uniquely qualified to know, but they know what happened or didn't happen when it comes to quote unquote collusion.
Yeah.
They know that's the source. They don't say anything. That means they are in they're colluding with people to undermine this president. Go ahead, Bill.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. I mean, they also have all the financial data too around the world. It's not a question that they don't have that either. And, of course, Trump has been under audit here for some time with the IRS. So if something was there, it should have come out, but it hasn't. But the other point that I would like to make is simply that Mueller doing the investigation has his hands really dirty in a lot of things. One, he's been using the warrantless collection of U.S. citizens inside this country and using it against them to pass it on for prosecution in a court of law. And they did that by doing parallel constructions. Once they find the data in the NSA material to go after them, it's been collected without a warrant, by the way, so they can't introduce it in the court of law. So once they do that and arrest the person, then they have to do what's called a parallel construction, that is, use standard policing techniques to find the same data. They already know where it is, so it makes it rather easy, and then they go find that and then substitute that in a court of law instead of using the original NSA data that they used to arrest them. This is called perjury, and it's a violation of the Fifth and the Sixth Amendments of the Constitution.
Right.
One, they're using their comments against them. That's a violation of the Fifth Amendment. And then they're substituting data as evidence in a court of law and not telling the defendant what the true data in use against them is. They have the right to challenge discovery, and they're not being told that. In fact, in Amnesty International versus the Clapper case that made it to the Supreme Court alleging that, the Solicitor General of the United States lied to the Supreme Court to get it thrown out, saying if anybody in the court of law, in a court of law, in a criminal case, any of the NSA data was used against them, they'd be told. That was an outright lie.
Let me go to Dave here before we go to the break. It means high officials can perjure themselves in front of Congress and not have any censure. But if you're under the microscope, anything you say can be used against you. Go ahead, Dave, before we go to the break. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously everything that's happened with the NSA spying program has been, you know, objectively unconstitutional, but we have a high court now that is run by people who basically turn the other way and give a pass to the government ever since 9/11. So all of these things, you know, you can say they're unconstitutional. And anybody who read the Constitution would look at it and say, yeah, that's right. But But the reality is unconstitutional. It's whatever the judges say.
Yeah, it's how you interpret it.
I'm
going to jump in here, gentlemen. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the Trump presidency. Stay with RT. Okay, so when, I want to go back to this Fusion GPS dossier. There's every reason to believe that Comey believed it, okay? During his congressional testimony, it sounded like he believed it. I think we can connect the dot that that's one of the reasons why Trump was infuriated, because he knows it's a fake dossier. But that dossier could have been a witness list to use to start questioning people here. And then, you know, then the unmasking of people. Hey, oh, we have a name here, so let's unmask them and we'll start listening to what they're talking about. I mean, this whole dossier, I mean, I've read it a number of times. It is bad fiction. It's just awful. And living where I live right now in the kind of conditions that I understand how things are done, it's like somebody wrote it in Disneyland. But this dossier, this fake dossier, is actually the basis for a lot of these investigations here. And the unmasking of people's names, which was illegal, which we'll probably never find out about. And I think that's one of the reasons why we need to know more about this dossier, the people that were involved in it, and also the connections that Manafort had with the Podesta brothers. Okay, these are real things you can grab on here and to investigate, and I think are quite legitimate, because after all, we want to know what happened in the 2016 election. The Democrats are not going down that rabbit hole. I want to go down that rabbit hole. Let's see if there was something that went wrong. Go ahead, Phil.
Yeah, well, there's certainly plenty of dirt that would stick to both sides, I think, in this case. The dossier itself is kind of interesting. I've worked in the private sector for investigative firms that operate internationally as well as for the government, and I know exactly what kind of document this is. This is a document that is sought by somebody who has an objective. He's not interested in the truth. He's interested in basically making a case against somebody that he's trying to get at, and the firm, which of course is also in business to make money, goes as far as it can to satisfy what the client wants. And that means that when you see one of these reports, they're absolutely predictable. They have a little bit of truth, which very often comes out of newspaper accounts and that sort of thing. They have other stuff that's quite speculative. I would note that the Steele dossier relied largely on anonymous sources that were unnamed. And then you go and you talk to people on the street that you think might know something, and they come up with some speculative stuff, and you put that in the report too. So I think that's exactly what we have here. And the fact that they would be using this as a basis for serious investigation to me is astonishing.
Yeah, it is astonishing, Bill, because it was just a sham. I mean, Christopher Steele and his associates, I mean, that was the money train. I mean, wow, they're going to pay this much money for this. Okay, yeah. Let's keep adding another chapter, another appendix, and let's keep it rolling. Okay, and whoever they talked to had very vivid imaginations. I have to really come to the conclusion that when it was presented to Trump and when he was president-elect, he probably thought, what in the world is this? But what is really interesting is that there are people, it seems like Comey and other people actually, and members of Congress, if you look at their testimony, asking questions, you know, they tend to believe this. What kind of people believe this kind of stuff? Go ahead, Bill.
Well, I would also point out that, for example, Julian Assange and everybody associated with him are watched cast iron by NSA and GCHQ electronically. And anybody else that helps them, like the other Five Eyes or another eight or nine other countries that are participating in this bulk acquisition, they're all looking at this and watching these people. So that means that if anybody did anything with them, it would be known by those agencies and be reported by them, which in that case of NSA, they would filter it through NSA, and NSA would redact the name. And the report would go out with a series check on it, seeing if anybody wanted to unmask that. So if anybody asked for that, that would be recorded at NSA, and they would know exactly who was unmasked and who asked for that to be unmasked. So that's not a question. And if you took the case of, in the case of Seth Rich, if he was making contacts with WikiLeaks, then his name would have been redacted, and someone would have had to request it. be unmasked. And if that was the case, they have a record of NSA there. And, you know, there's no question this should be known already, and it's in the NSA databases or the GCHQ databases or both.
You know, Dave, one of the things I find really mystifying is why doesn't Trump, with his executive power, demand to find out who unmasked these names of people and an investigation into the leaks, because people definitely have a vested interest, material interest, ideological interest in doing these things. I mean, of course, the liberal media calls them all heroes, okay? I suppose the leaker is, you know, depending on what political fence you're on. But it seems that is Trump impotent? Is he unable to have these things done? Go ahead, Dave.
Well, his executive power is not as great as you're suggesting. I mean, when it comes to the Justice Department and Justice Department investigations, which is what that would have to be, there is a sort of let's say it's an unwritten rule, but fairly stiffly followed, that presidents aren't allowed to go to the Justice Department and tell them, I want you to investigate this person, I want you to investigate that. That's sort of crossing a line that would get him in trouble with everybody.
Okay, but we could ask, could you investigate the leaking? Where does this leaking come from? That's not targeting an individual. It's protecting national security. I mean, that's within his purview, surely, Dave.
Can I add something here?
Okay, go ahead. Jump in, Bill.
Yeah, if it's
can
not
I add
a...
Something when you're,
yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead, Bill. Go ahead. Jump in.
I was going to say that the president can order NSA to deliver up the list of names that were unmasked and who requested that. He can order that from the NSA. It's a department under him. He doesn't have to have the Justice Department do that.
Do you want to keep going, Dave? Do you want to finish your comment? Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I just was saying there are limits to how far he can go, and they're not legal ones. They're also political ones that... You know, if he looks like he's trying to block the investigation in some way or undermine it, you know, he has to tread carefully because he's going to wind up alienating people that he needs to have support him on the Republican side. So I think he's not as free to act as you might think that, you know, that just the objective powers he has allow him to do.
Phil, weigh in on that. I mean, just how much power does the president have to protect himself from these attacks here? Of course, there's the issues of propriety and all of that. But, I mean, these people actually work for him. Do you feel that there's a lot of resistance around him not to inform him of things, not to give him options? Because I get that impression sometimes. But understanding Trump is, you know... That will be a whole academic field one day, Trump studies. Go ahead, Phil.
yeah, I would indeed. I kind of agree with Dave on this. I think it's a question of unseemly behavior that he would face a lot of criticism for, which he doesn't need at this point. But on the other hand, let's face it, when President Obama was in there with his advisors, and he's kind of made suggestions that he would like to know more about something, but he didn't want to put it on paper or make a permanent record, you know damn well that the Attorney General and his immediate staff are going to do what the president wants.
Yep.
And the same thing is true now with Donald Trump. But Trump is in much deeper waters, and I think the fact is that he has to be Caesar's wife in this. He has to be essentially, to a certain extent, be playing the game. He cannot look like he's subverting the investigation. And I bet he already knows a lot of this information we're talking about. I think Bill has made clear that he would have access to quite a bit of this information. But the fact is, it would be probably a mistake on his part to try to use it.
You know, Bill,
I think the point to make here
ahead,
is that
in.
Trump is a
go ahead, jump
Trump
in
is a weak and Trump is a weak. Trump has been very severely weakened by all these scandals and by his own, you know, inept use of Twitter. His popularity is as low as any president at this point in a term historically. In the history of polling, it makes him a very weak person, and that was not the case with Obama.
Right.
As much as Republicans were attacking Obama, he had a lot of popularity across the country. So So it puts Trump in a very weak position to fight against this stuff. You know, and he has to tread carefully.
Yeah, but William, let me go back to you a bit. I mean, we heard all of these scandals. I would preface that by saying perception of scandals, okay? Because there are real scandals,
right,
and there are real questions out there, but they're not really surrounding Donald Trump. They go back to the losing candidate and the losing party and all of their cronies and all of their lobbyists. Because, again, as I keep stressing in this program, those are things you can grab onto and discuss, okay? You know, what he said, she said during a conversation during the campaign about Russian adoption. I mean, you know, wow, that's shaking the pillars of the Constitution here. I mean, this you can't grab onto it. Okay, Phil, I'm going to give you the last minute on the program here. What is going to happen next here? I mean, with these indictments, is that a signal to you that it's the beginning of the end or the end of the beginning? How do you perceive it?
Well, my feeling is that if there had been any criminal behavior on the part of the president, which would be the only real grounds for impeachment, we would know that already. And so I think that we are going to see Donald Trump serving out his presidency. But as Dave suggested, he's in a very weak position. He will be a very weak president. I'm not so sure he's going to get his tax program through. I'm not so sure he's going to get any other major legislation through. So he will be like a permanent lame duck. This is unfortunate because there were good things that Donald Trump talked about in the campaign, like getting a handle on immigration, getting out of the wars in the Middle East.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, these things have not borne fruit. And I have a feeling that they will not bear fruit. I think we might see serious aggression.
That means the liberal media and the deep state have won. Okay, that's all the time we have, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests in Washington and in Philadelphia. Yep. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.